Uh-oh, what's this?
It's a hat.
Okay. Why don't you do this then?
Sahana Bhavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Mavidvrishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I just remember tomorrow is Friday. Are you taking Friday off?
We said Saturday. Friday.
Are you starting now? Or?
And then we thought if it's okay with you that we this week, because we started so late, that we have only Saturday.
Okay, well, yeah, either is fine with me.
Yeah.
I just was thinking it was Friday and Saturday. So it's half day Friday and all day Saturday. But this time,
yep.
We'll just do Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good.
Mm-hmm. Ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Boiling up. I hear this, the word dharma being used as like one's dharma. And are they really meaning swadharma? And can you talk about swadharma and dharma and how they how they're used properly?
The dharma has many different meanings, and so it depends upon the context. Like one meaning of dharma is like a guna, a quality. If you this object has these dharmas, and this has like gunas, so uh-huh. It can be used like a quality.
Uh-huh.
It can also dharma. Can be used in terms of Ishwara, the infinite order of things. Ishwara's dharma is all the infinite order. It can be used like that too. And then if you say, it's my dharma, then it's being used as duties. These are my dharmas. These are my duties. That's one really common way. So if you say, it's my swadharma, normally it depends on the context. It would mean, these are my duties, this is my prarabdha, this is what's being asked of me in this life. So the dharmas that are mine, that belong to me. So then in that case, I don't take it as gunas or qualities, but I take it usually as the duties that you have in any, the expectations, what is expected of you in any given moment is your swadharma.
Kind of like your karma, like your prarabdha.
It's your karma, it's the prarabdha karma.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so say if you understand prarabdha karma and you look at it as your dharma, how do you respond to your prarabdha karma? You respond to it dharmically, and you can say, this is my dharma. This is what's meant for me to do in this situation. It's my dharma. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I have a question. Mm. This question came up from someone in a retreat we had recently. We were talking about inner child and different ways to heal and on also things like EFT and EMDR and all.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was asking, what about in relation to children, because she had a child who had a trauma that he'd been bitten by a bee, and then as soon as he heard a sound that sounded like a bee, any kind of sound, it was like he went into some sort of panic.
Yeah.
So I would be curious to hear about techniques to use in relation to children for traumas like that.
You mean to have the child do the inner child work?
No, actually I think that was more maybe in terms of EMDR and things, but in general, traumas, like how to heal traumas that children have when they are still children. Because that seems like quite a, like that particular event seems like it wouldn't be so hard to heal for that child. But how to do that?
I'm not sure. I haven't worked with children that much, so, but one thing that I know that often, and just in my limited training with working with children, is especially sand play, all different kinds of play. Like sand play is where you have a little square, a little rectangle of sand, and then all kinds of figures, all kinds, like a whole world of figurines, including, you know, trees and rocks and houses and anything imaginable. Monsters and people and the firemen and the policemen, all kinds of figures. Maybe I had, when I had my sand tray for my clients, I had probably 1,500 figures. Mm-hmm. All different kinds of trees, everything. And so with a little child, what they do is they just play in the sand and they build things in the sand and then they put things in it, you know. And that's really it's the unconscious talking in a way. And so usually you're just there and you're watching and they like that you're really watching, you know. And then when they're done, then they tell you about it, you know, and then you can elaborate on what they're telling you. Like say they have a violent father. And in drawing you can do the same thing. They might draw a household with, you know, the mom bleeding or something like that and the father being standing really angry. They just draw these things. It just comes out. You know, and then you might say something like, if you see it in the tray or in the painting, whatever they do, say, oh, your dad looks mad there. Is your dad mad? And then when you look at the picture, yeah, he's really angry. Then you say, well, what happened? You know, and then they start just telling you about the picture, and that's something that kind of brings it out, because they're talking about the picture, your dad in the picture. Mm-hmm. And so going, and then you'll find that they will draw the same picture or do the same type of sand tray, or sometimes we use a dollhouse with all kinds of figurines. They'll do the same thing over and over, mm-hmm. working it through. So one thing we do with adults when they have a post-traumatic stress, really a trauma that is incapacitating them. One thing that really is helpful is if they can tell the story over and over and over again. Not just once, but exactly what happened, everything that they remember, just tell the story. And then they'll tell it again and again. Maybe they'll tell you the story 100 times. But each time they tell the story, there's more affect that's being released, and it becomes more, metabolized in the system. And so they do, I know they do the same thing with children. You know, they let them play it out over and over again, and then the therapist doesn't say very much, but just notices this and notices that. And then sometimes when they're doing the drawing or they're making the little a dollhouse or the sand tray, they'll say something as they're doing it. They'll just make a comment here and a comment there about what's happening, and then you can say, oh, I see that. You know, not very much. It's just that kind of acknowledgement, and that helps them work through it. So say it was a bee sting. I don't know if it would work for a bee sting or not. But there's something about the bees really frightened them, so maybe if they were drawing a picture, you would see these big bees coming at them or something. Or they're their little body is there, and then this great big bee is circling down toward them. And then you just say something like, that's the bee. That's the bee. And they'd go, that's the bee that stung me, that's the bee, you know. And I'd say, yeah, that's the bee. And then they would draw it in other ways and talk about it and somehow work it through. So I'm sure there's many, many other things in child psychology. You know, there's different areas that you specialize in, child psychology for certain age groups, for teenagers, you know, for people in, you know, like in latency, kind of those mid years of 8 to 12, like there. So you can specialize in those years, and then the teenage years, then there's couples counseling, and they're all specialties where, so I'm more Jungian-oriented, depth psychology, more spiritual counseling, people who are doing that type of inquiry. So EMDR might be good for that.
Yeah. Maybe if they have electrodes in the hands or something, then they don't have to move the eyes.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
What is EMDR?
I'm used to the...
Yeah.
EMDR is a technique that's found to be very effective for the post-traumatic stress syndromes, especially for veterans that have come back from war, you know, where they've had horrific experiences. And they found that this EMDR, which has to do with the movement of the eyes as they're telling the story, and they have sometimes a pendulum that's swinging, and maybe they have different devices now, and that cause the eyes to move as they're telling the story, and that seems to release a lot of trauma. And they found, just for the different studies, when the eyes are in the right-hand corner, it's a memory. I don't remember which is which, but this can be a memory. This can be a really ancient past memory. You know, this can be a fabrication. This can be the present, depending on where the eyes are. What happens to the eyes when you're talking? If they've mapped it all out. And so the EMDR, the eyes are moving in every direction, you know, as they're telling the story, and somehow that is a science to it. I haven't studied it that much, but it's been proven, actually, statistically, it's very effective for post-traumatic stress, especially the veterans who come back. They've used it a lot on them. Because so many of them are really suffering from flashbacks and, you know, reliving the experiences. So I just think I almost have just a layperson's knowledge of all of that.
I was thinking about the meditation this morning, about using expression in the face and body to change the emotion. But also think about what you also say about, you know, sometimes we have to fake it until we make it, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in behavior-wise, I think.
Yes.
I mean, even if I, for example, if I get angry or something, that I, you know, don't say it and maybe try to say something nice.
The opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though, yeah, of course, that person maybe feels that I'm not really, I'm tense,
yeah.
You know. So how can I use that then? Because sometimes it feels like I don't really have time to, if it happens fast, you know, in a situation. If something triggers me and I have to respond, and it will show what I feel, even though I try to say something nice.
You didn't catch it in time, but even if there is a kind of like you're feeling one thing, but then acting, saying something else, it's similar to, even though I know what you're saying, it's like there's a discord there,
yeah.
And the other person may pick up on that discord. But it's actually kind of similar to the meditation we did, where if you say you're depressed or sad or whatever, and your face and whole body are going to be having that expression, just unless you do something to change it, it will just naturally, the face will reflect in the body, in the posture, everything will be an expression of that sorrow or whatever the emotion is. And so you find that if you catch that, and say in meditation, for instance, or even when you are walking along and you notice it, you can actually change your expression, and that will very much change the mood.
Yeah.
You know. And so I know what you mean about that discord, but actually even with the Pratipaksha Bhavana, it changes the mood. Or say you're angry at somebody but you do a kind act, that action, that physicalization of kindness, of that kind act or of that warm loving act, actually transforms the angry feeling like that. So then we use that for that. The other is more of, when Swamiji says fake it till you make it, that has kind of a negative connotation in our language, in English. If I say fake it till you make it, you know, it means you're faking it. It's not, you're not sincere, it's not real. But what he actually means, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek when he says that, is that express your values, even if you're suffering from some sort of a reaction or some sort of, you know, anger or dislike or something, express the values. And then what you find is that your psyche, your emotions will transform to that expression, because that expression is not a lie. It is what you value, you know. It's just that your emotions are reacting in this way and that way. And so since it's what you value, there's a tremendous, you're going for the Dharma. And so there's a big relief that takes place there when you do that. And the hatred or the anger or the frustration or whatever leaves, transforms. Not all the time, but very often, most of the time, I would say. Yeah. These things they're so wonderful. They're wonderful to actually go around and kind of practice it, because you can keep experiencing the kind of the subtle shifts that take place. Like when we did the meditation of taking that face, that gentle smile of the Murti, you know. Say if you're feeling you're talking with somebody or something's going on and you're irritable, you know. You can actually just take that posture, that gentle smile. Nobody else needs, it's so gentle and subtle, nobody even needs to notice it, you know. But you just take that relaxation of the eyes, even if you don't close your eyes. Say I'm irritated and somebody's talking to me and go... That'll fix it. Let's be careful of that one. But it can be very subtle, and it actually shifts you into a different space. You know, these are just things to amazing things. You know, relationships that are there, that as you start practicing them in this way or that way, you notice. And it's just a way of relieving your reactions or your irritations or your discomfort or whatever it is that you're suffering from, and everyone around you is suffering too. We always pick up on that, you know. Even if you're trying to be kind of cool and quiet about it, everybody knows. They'll pick it up. Not that that's wrong. I mean, everybody is, you know, has all the whole gamut of emotions, and we do what we can with them. So it's not about being right or wrong. It's about having tools to just, you know, release that in very, very subtle and simple ways. So. Mm-hmm.
about guilt a little bit? I remember just like some, I remember Putaswamiji saying that guilt is something we cannot really
get rid
of without.
That what?
That we cannot really get rid of without of guilt without Vedanta. And that there is like a the guilt that is more the that is there in all beings.
I don't know about the guilt. I don't know what he meant by that. I'd have to think about that guilt that is there in all beings. But we all have some guilt. And guilt is something that we did that was wrong in our from our vantage point. And you regret. You feel guilty for having done that. And you know it was not the right thing to do. And I think, I don't know, I have 3 or 4 of those in my lifetime. That, and there might be many others, but they weren't significant enough to be things that you just remember, you know. And Swamiji did once say that guilt doesn't go away. Guilt doesn't go away, but you can diffuse it and it can become mitya. You know, but it doesn't actually seem to go away, which is interesting. I think that you can get rid of the affect, the big affect of it, but the scar of it doesn't seem to go away, you know. And if I did something and I really, and it happened, I did do that. It's a fact. I did that thing. And it wasn't right. And I really wish that I had not done it. And 10 years later, still, it wasn't right. And I really wish I had not done it. You know, and 60 years later, it wasn't right. I really wish that I hadn't done it. But how much... So the fact of it doesn't go away, you know. But the that may be the accusatory nature that look what you did this, you bad, guilty person. That part goes away because in a sense you accept that you did that and you accept that it wasn't wrong and you accept that you wish you didn't, hadn't done that. But it's a fact that that happened, and you're sorry for it, you know. And but there's not more; it's not more happening than that. Or maybe earlier on, you have more affect involved. What do you think from your own experience? Yeah. No, I mean you asked the question, so I'm just. And Swamiji had mentioned that, so I'd always looked into myself to see, is that really true? You know, that these guilts, they don't really go away. They don't transform. But maybe the affect-laden self-blame and recrimination goes away, but not the sorrow or the feeling that was something you really wish you had it done. You know, that doesn't go away. But all of the inflammation around it goes away, especially with knowledge. There's other things, other ways to hold it because it doesn't, it's not that it becomes all right, but it's humbling because you have to realize that I don't know that there's any exceptions. Is there a person that is proud of everything that they've done or that has never done something that you wish you hadn't done? You know? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe there's somebody there. But most of us, or most of us, we have a little handful of things that were big enough that you don't forget. There's probably all kinds of little things you wish you hadn't done, but they're not significant enough that you remember them, unless you have kind of an obsessive compulsive disorder. You list every tiny little thing. I have a neighbor like that who's very kind of an authoritarian fellow. You know, he's older and he's in his mid 70s, and so is his wife. But he has a very authoritarian nature, and he wants to be in control of everything, and he wants the area, which now we're living in. Here's his farm and here's our farm, you know, and they share a fence. And that used to belong to his whole family. And so he notices everything from the time we arrived, which is now about 4 years ago. He remembers every infraction. And one time we were talking and he was annoyed about something. And I don't know what brought it up, but he somehow, something I said, I don't remember what it was. He said, well, you did this, and then you did this, and then you did this, and then you did this. And he had a tremendous memory of all of these things. And I said something like, wow, you remember all of that. Some of that took place 4 years ago. You know, one was that somebody was driving to, one of our students that was coming was driving to the property, and they're supposed to go 5 miles an hour. Which, as they come up the road. And so this person was coming like 20 miles an hour. And he said, the sign says 5 miles an hour. This person was coming at least 20 miles an hour. She almost ran into me. I know who that person was. I know what happened. Anyway. But that was one. Another one was somebody, you were having people over and they drove all the way up my driveway. You know, you didn't make clear to them not to go to the left. They went to the left up my driveway. That happened with, he described the car that did it. It's really, really amazing. You know. So, what if you had that internalized, your all the bad things you did for yourself? I wish I hadn't driven that car for 20 miles an hour. I wish I hadn't have done that. It feels so badly. Why did I do that? Why, when I was driving, it did say in the directions to go to the right. Why did I go to the left? I feel so badly. Because, you know, you have to be careful of yourself. You know, you can overthink things. Yeah.
Is there a difference then between like guilt that comes from early childhood and kind of guilt that you feel from things you did as an adult?
Things, well, there probably is a difference, but
like the one when you're a young child, can that guilt go?
Well, I don't even know at what age you would really start having guilt. It more is like having shame, being shamed, you know, because then you feel that you are not lovable, that your parents don't want you, or their parents don't love you, you know. So it's all internalized like that, because they might be having a bad day and yell at you, but then you take it as, I'm not any good, you know, I'm no good, I'm a bad person. But to have guilt means that you have to have that cognitive ability to say, I did this, and I should not have done that. So the mind has to be a little bit more mature. And that type of logical relationships usually come around 6 or 7. Then maybe you can have some guilt when you're earlier, but it's not as a simple matter. You know, because you have to know right and wrong, and then realize that you've chosen to do something that is wrong instead of what you should have done. Yeah.
But what if the parents tell you that you are the fault?
Then you take it that yes, I'm the fault.
Then you feel different.
You feel that there's something wrong with you.
It's not the same thing.
It's not the same thing. Yeah. That you feel that you're bad. Yeah. So when we say, you know, where's the self-esteem or the self-love or the self-worth? If you're told over and over because of the parents' irritation or their anger at you, you feel, you know, no good or unlovable or unwanted or not worthy of anything. All of these, this whole basket of emotions or something that take place.
I feel that the Pratipaksha Bhavana, I did the best I could at that time. That was what I could do. That was the decision I could make. Now I can see more clearly. That can definitely diffuse the... It's worked for me.
For guilt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. At least it lessened the impact. Yeah. If it pops up again, it doesn't hold up much of the charge around it. It seems to be like, that's what I could do.
Yeah. I think that's really a helpful way to hold it, because I guess when I had the more adult guilt, that is actually helpful. I just look at it, and that is helpful just to say, well, you did the best that you could do. But the fact is that you knew, I mean, you weren't able to help yourself. You can say that, or you would have made another choice. But the choice that you made was very hurtful to the other, you know. But it's also true that sometimes those choices and things that we do at that time and at that level of maturity, we don't have the strength, or we don't have it in us to do better. And so there's some compassion there too. And that's really helpful. Because it's also true, you know.
There's also that guilt that's not really... It's like you can almost feel it in the airport when they're searching your bags, and you're kind of like, you didn't do anything wrong, or you just did something and then somebody got hurt. You're just living your life and they got hurt.
Yeah.
And you can kind of feel guilty about it, but it's not...
But it's not a legitimate,
deep.
Really.
Yeah,
it's not so deep.
Kind
of
level, just seeing the...
But the pain, objectively, what happened.
I guess if there's a dharmic choice and you consciously
do the adharma.
Choose the adharma, when you know better.
Yeah, you know better. But even then, when that's true, and that's why you would feel guilty, because you know better and you shouldn't have made that choice. But then there are reasons that you made that choice, that you did that. And it has to do with your own limitations, who you were at that time, and you know why you... And that's a good thing to understand. That's why Swamiji doesn't like the word forgiveness. You know, he likes the word understanding. You have to understand why you did that. What was involved? What were the, you know, mitigating circumstances that caused you to do something like that? You know. And then that brings about understanding and compassion for yourself and for others, instead of just saying, you did the wrong thing, but I forgive you. You know, the understanding is more real somehow.
Choosing it consciously, but it's part of the setup.
Yeah, I don't know how to strictly to interpret all of that. Once you know the Jains in the Jain religion, they take ahimsa to the extreme, to extreme degrees, to where they will walk around with a mask, you know, like a gauze mask, and also a very kind of light, very light little brush, so that they won't breathe in and kill any of the little creatures, little insects and things, and that they won't also step on the ants and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And they, because it's a papa, even though you may be doing it kind of unconsciously or not paying attention or not really caring, you know. It's still a papa. And Swamiji's talked about it that way too. That even I think in the Shastra, and I have to go back, it's not really the Upanishads or anything, it's like in the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, these stories talk of these small, what we call small things as a papa. But I can actually understand that. We don't usually have that level of sensitivity. You know, you don't realize like ants are intelligent little creatures. They actually have intelligence. They actually think, and they have intelligent relationships between themselves, and they even train the worker ants. So there's a lot of studies done on this. So they're a society of creatures. You know, it's just that we're giants, and to from our size, they are like a little insignificant. And, you know, they have no significance at all. So if you know, wipe them up with a sponge or blow them down the drain or whatever, they're in your way, you know. And so it's just an unconscious act. It's an insensitive act. But most of us don't go to that level of sensitivity where we're that careful about smaller beings. But then if you think of, you know, what if this planet had beings that were so large that we were the size of ants, you know, and they were just clomping around, and we were even to run to get away from their boot would be a long run. It would be very difficult to do that. How we would be scrambling as these giants are walking around. So, and then the poor giant that actually cares, that's a big job, you know, to care about all these little microscopic creatures like the giants, you know. One time, I've told this story before, but this is in the early 70s when I'd first come to the met Swamiji and only known him for some months, for less than a year, I would say. And he was late for coming out to satsang. He was in his bathroom, which was, he had this little square kutir, and then in the back there was the kind of the bathroom shower area. And so he wasn't coming out. What he was doing was that there were all these ants that were in the around the shower, you know. And so he was picking all those he was picking them all up and taking them out. He didn't have the heart to just put them down the drain. And so he was saving all of these ants. I like that. It's a sensitivity. You know, not just picking a flower. You know, that flower is so beautiful. It's there on the bush for all beings to enjoy. You know. And then why would you just pluck its life in the prime of its beauty? So even though in India we pluck so many flowers and then we take the petals and everything, you know, and offer them to the Lord in the puja. But for Swamiji, at least that during that period of his life, I just imagine it was always that way. Those were just things he didn't do. You know, because why disturb that living creature? Or why not just enjoy it there on the bush, or, you know. Or if you can catch a, you know, mosquito with your hand and take it and let it go, why would you choose to do that rather than that?
Because they sting.
I know, yeah. Anyway, the level of sensitivity that we can find ourselves going to can become, you know, really kind of stifling in a way. And so we draw our boundaries around our level of sensitivity that we have. Yeah. But sometimes I think the boundaries that we draw are a little too small. where the certain types of sensitivity to other beings would not really hurt us at all, to give up any himsa or injury. That it's not something that is hard for us to give up. We can actually give up those types of ahimsas, you know, the pain that we cause to other beings. It's not hard for us to give up. And we just don't give it up for our own pleasure. And because of our own lack of understanding, lack of education, really, I think. But when you do give up some of those ways that we are really involved in the hurting of other beings, when you do give it up, you feel a lot better. You feel so much better, so much lighter, so much, you know, it makes a big difference. And since we've been conditioned to not have any consciousness around other beings that aren't human beings, we don't have much consciousness around them as beings even. You know. We've been very conditioned to not even think about that. And so then it takes kind of a major awakening over and over and over just to realize that is something we should never do. To really know that, you know. When I was younger, because Swamiji was always a vegetarian, he never wore leather, never, he was always a vegetarian. And I was a vegetarian also from about 18 on. But I was a vegetarian because he was. And also because I felt that was the right thing to do. But I never had any feeling. It was never involved with feelings. Like with Swamiji, he really loved those beings, you know. It really mattered to him on an emotional level. He had an emotional relationship with all beings, a love relationship. And for me, with meat, if you go into the, and you see meat, for me it was just packaged meat. It was all just packaged meat. I didn't connect, my heart didn't connect with it. I just didn't do it because I felt that it was the wrong thing to do, but I had no heart, no feelings. And I used to think that's so strange. Will I ever have any feelings around this and around these animals and around, you know, eating meat or things like that? Will I ever have any feelings? And I didn't have any, I didn't do it, but I didn't have any feelings at all for probably 30 or 40 years. That's amazing to me. I said, have some feelings. No. That's some really heavy-duty conditioning. Yeah.
I have a friend at home. She's vegan. She's very connected with plants. But she also eats like roadkill. Because she feels like that's almost like that's given. And she, from her perspective, she feels it's more like violence to eat the plant than this meat that's already kind of there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, in the Shastra, not in terms of eating meat, because for the most part, they're not completely vegetarian either, all in years, but what they do say is you need deer skin to put on the ground for meditation, because the deer skin won't absorb the water, it won't get wet. So you need to have a deer skin, and on top of the deer skin, you would put like a cloth or straw or something, and that would be an asana. But the deer had to be like roadkill. It had to be something, it had to have died naturally. It couldn't be something that was killed. If it was killed, then you couldn't use it. That kind of reminds me of that. Mm-hmm.
outside of the aspect, like what the, I mean, the energy or vibration you get from actually eating meat and an animal that was probably very scared and pain and all this. Would you say there is any hinsa in eating this roadkill?
I probably don't really think about it one way or the other, I guess, but I don't think of meat as food for humans.
Yeah.
So that's another issue, right?
Yeah.
So, also, if it was a roadkill, the other negative thing about that is that it's going to have all kinds of hormones and pain and things running through it.
Yeah.
So you'd be eating that fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's another negative around that.
That is not very aesthetic.
Very what?
Empathic.
Not very aesthetic. Mm. Not very beautiful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Really?
It's 4 months when we came.
Now we're going to have rain for 4 months?
Yeah. It's been dry for 4 months.
Oh, I see. Right. I see. Now we're getting the rain. Rain is a blessing. Anything else? We have a few more minutes. We can migrate into the budgings. Should we?
Rama Nama Tarakam. Sada Bhajo Re. Sada Bhajo Re. Sada Bhajo Re.
Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayam Tam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishah Gobrahmadevya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Bharahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhavade Asato Ma Satyamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om